Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, turmoil in the Middle East and the U.S. role in the world. Our guest, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He is currently chairman of Projects International. That's an international business development firm based in Washington. And we're coming to you from his office here in Washington. As a result of his long and distinguished career as a U.S. diplomat, Ambassador Freeman has earned the highest public service awards of the Department of Defense for his roles in designating a NATO-centered post-Cold War European security system and in reestablishing defense and military relations with China. Ambassador Freeman was also Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He is the recipient of numerous high honors and awards, a popular public speaker, and author of 5 books. We'll talk with Ambassador Freeman about the turmoil in the Middle East, from Iraq to Syria, to the tenuous ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, as well as touch on the crisis in Ukraine and China's increasingly aggressive stance in the South China Sea. Ambassador Freeman, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
And again, thanks for hosting us here in your office. Well, Ambassador Freeman, you've written extensively about the situation in the Middle East, around the world. I'd like you to give us a brief critique of U.S. foreign policy in the post-Cold War era.
Well, I don't think U.S. foreign policy has found its stride in the post-Cold War era. We seem to be trying to defend the military supremacy globally that the end of the Cold War bequeathed us. We don't seem to have very many new ideas, and we don't seem to be accommodating new realities very well. You can find examples of this all over the place, not just in our difficulty in dealing with the rise of China, for example, but global institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, all of which were created under American leadership, have languished. Necessary reforms are not being made, and now people are beginning to do workarounds. The so-called BRICS have created a couple of alternative institutions, a bank to take effect in 2016. In Asia, we have an Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that's just been formed that, in effect, obviates much of the Asian Development Bank's work. So we don't seem to be leading. We don't seem to have the vision and the energy and ambition that we once did.
Let's go right to the situation in the Middle East, particularly with the so-called Islamic State, ISIS, and their incursions into Iraq, taking so much territory in the north and the west. We know that their origins began principally in Syria. We recently heard former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talk about what she saw as a failure to help build a credible fighting force among the Free Syrian Army against President Bashar al-Assad way back, when there was an uprising against him. She says that this created a big vacuum which the jihadi forces such as al-Nusra and, of course, the Islamic State, ISIS, have filled. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think the mistake there was in saying at the outset that Bashar al-Assad would go, he will go, and he must go, leaving the impression that this was a major objective of the United States behind which we would put whatever was necessary to achieve it. It wasn't moderates versus jihadis or whatever. The issue was, were we in fact committed to the removal of the Assad regime? Rhetorically, we were. In other terms, we were not. And very quickly, the situation in Syria fractured along ethnic and sectarian lines in ways that we couldn't hope to control. I don't think forming some sort of moderate force, if indeed that would have been possible at the outset, was the answer. And I don't think failing to do it was the mistake. We simply overreached. We had assumptions that were wrong about the staying power of the regime and its relationship to Syrian society. We didn't cooperate effectively with those who really were committed to getting rid of the Assad regime, the Saudis, the Qataris in particular. And we're left with a mess, more than a mess. It's a very dangerous situation.
That is probably an understatement, as you said, and now we're looking at the situation in Iraq. They have made incursions into northern Iraq. We know that that's been compounded by the fact that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has refused to step down, but we now have a new nominated prime minister. We'll see how that goes, but I'd like to get your assessment of the situation in Iraq as ISIS continues to surge and the U.S. is trying to contain its gains through both military strikes and military assistance to the Kurds. What do you think the prospects are for checking ISIS and for political reconciliation in Iraq?
I think the prospects for political reconciliation in Iraq are poor. The Kurds are already on their way out of Iraq and into independence. I don't see them turning back. The Shia in Iraq are themselves divided into several factions having to do with their relationship and attitude toward Iran. And the Sunnis have been, in effect, co-opted, at least for the time being, by this Islamic State. The Islamic State is different from previous opponents we have faced. It is hardcore. It is well-trained as a result of a Darwinian process of natural selection of fighting the U.S. in Iraq and the Assad forces in Syria. It's tough, it's organized, it is well-led, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. In fact, we are, I think, left with a situation in which the only hope we have for the collapse of this menace is its own internal mistakes. These people have shown in the past that they will overreach, that they will commit atrocities against their own kind so that they fall from grace in the eyes of the ordinary people, lose support, and become vulnerable. But short of that, these guys are on a roll and it's not going to be stopped anytime soon.
Do you think that ISIS poses not only a threat to Syria and Iraq, but also the entire region? And do you think they have any sights on striking Western European targets?
These are people who do not believe in national borders. They believe in a community constructed around Islam and their very deviant and peculiar view of Islam. They don't agree with what Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot did in creating Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, still less Israel, a sixth state that emerged from that colonial exercise. They don't agree with any of that and have said explicitly that they're determined to destroy it. They also have as an explicit objective striking the American homeland to the extent the United States opposes them, which we obviously do and are. So this is a very disruptive, destabilizing, and globally menacing development, in my view.
Back to the strategy to try to either defeat ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but also, you know, what is the most effective way to stabilize Iraq at this point? What are your thoughts with regard to that strategy?
Well, the only way that what remains of Iraq now is partitioned. Let's face it, Kurdistan is not subject to the direction of Baghdad, has not been for quite some time. That is, the northern Kurdish region of Iraq is becoming an independent state in its own right. It is linked to the Kurds in Syria, who are also taking their own course, apart from Damascus and apart from anybody else. The jihadistan that calls itself the Islamic State is yet another polity which straddles the Syrian and Iraqi border, and which is the size of Britain. This is not a small area, and it is one of the cradles of human civilization. It is not insignificant in its own right. The rest of Iraq, that which is under the control nominally of Baghdad, is itself divided. So the first question is, can the government in Baghdad get its act together? And so far, the answer is it has not. One can hope that it will, but that's the prerequisite for doing anything in what remains of Iraq. I think overall, however, we're looking at the unraveling of the post-World War I Sykes-Picot order in the region, and Iraq and Syria are probably not the end of that process.
So you see pretty much an unraveling of those borders?
I think countries like Lebanon and Jordan are particularly vulnerable. Lebanon, of course, is split along some of the same lines as Syria, and it has, in effect, a state within a state in areas that are administered and taken care of by Hezbollah. Jordan is an artificial buffer state. It exists because it's convenient to Israel, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. Saudi Arabia is fine, but the others are all in great difficulty, and it's under huge pressure.
If the nominee for Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi in Iraq is able to form a new cabinet, do you see a way where the previously alienated Sunni population, who are now to some extent aligning themselves with ISIS because they are so angered by the Shiite-led government of Prime Minister Maliki, do you see a way that the Sunnis could abandon ISIS, ISIL, however you want to call them, and somehow you defeat them as well as then have a more viable Iraqi state, even without the Kurdish north?
Well, that's really two questions, I think. On the question of Sunnis separating themselves from the Islamic State, that's entirely possible if the Islamic State overplays its hand, as many think it may do. Certainly, the majority of Sunnis in Iraq are not comfortable with the kind of barbaric extremism that the Islamic State represents. So the question then is, if they want to flee the Islamic State, if not physically, at least in terms of their orientation, where do they go? And that really, in many respects, takes us back to the question you asked before. Can the government in Baghdad get its act together? And that, in turn, depends really less on the United States than on Iran. Iran has withdrawn its support from Maliki and thrown its support behind Mr. al-Abadi. And that may be enough to produce some kind of reconciliation and union in the government-controlled part of Iraq. If so, then the Iranians have also been very much aware that Maliki has done nothing to conciliate the Sunnis and everything to alienate them. And they've been arguing all along, as we have in the United States, that the government in Baghdad needs to become inclusive rather than exclusive. So a combination of people being turned off by the Islamic State and Baghdad getting its act together would produce a new situation, but we're not there.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Chaz Freeman, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. Also, check out and like our Facebook fan page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Clay Red from South Africa. Well, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, let's stick with the Middle East just a few minutes longer. I wanted you to address the role of Saudi Arabia as well as Qatar in the region. Their influence basically on Iraq and even with regard to Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, these are the two so-called Wahhabi or Salafi Islamist states in the region, but they're really quite different. In Saudi Arabia is a very large society with quite a bit of diversity, and some of that diversity includes people who are religiously quite extreme and who are prepared to donate a lot of money out of religious conviction to propagate their faith, their particular version of the faith, elsewhere. Qatar is a smaller, more coherent, more cohesive society where the government really is in a position to control a lot of what happens. Both of them became involved very early on in supporting the forces against Bashar al-Assad, but they have different clients and different constituencies. And Qatar has been quite aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood generally in the region. Saudi Arabia detests the Muslim Brotherhood for many reasons, not least its democratic pretensions. So they had a falling out in Syria and I think ended up probably making the opposition to Assad less effective than it might have been. Their major differences, however, have been expressed in Egypt, where Qatar supported the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood government. Saudi Arabia was quite standoffish. Saudi Arabia is totally behind the al-Sisi military dictatorship. Qatar is quite on the outs with that. And these differences have in turn led to a split in the Gulf Cooperation Council. Qatar and Saudi Arabia against each other in many respects. UAE, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, others also aligned against Qatar. It's a very complex situation. I haven't even begun to talk about the Iranian dimension of it.
To what extent do either Qatar or Saudi Arabia actually exacerbate the problems we're seeing both in Syria and Iraq?
Well, I think they both have followed a sectarian foreign policy, which I have always found rather puzzling, because if you are trying to unite the Arab world, let's say Iraqis, for example, behind opposition to Iran, why wouldn't you emphasize your Arabness instead of your sectarian identity, which is not appealing to the majority of Iraqis? But anyway, they have opted to pursue a religiously oriented set of foreign policies, and I think this has added fuel to the fire in the region.
You alluded to Iran, and with Iran being a predominantly Shiite state, a state, of course, that these Persian Gulf countries, Sunni countries, are very opposed to. Talk about the proxy war that we're witnessing over Syria, over Iraq, between Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf Sunni states against Iran.
Well, you're quite right. The struggle in Syria is part civil strife, civil war, if you will, among Syrians, and part a proxy war between different external contenders, with the Gulf Arabs on one side and Iran on the other. Of course, the Gulf Arabs, as we were just discussing, have now divided and are no longer unified in their position. This goes back to both the dawn of Islam, the difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and to longstanding Arab apprehensions about Iran's imperial ambitions in the region. Ironically, the net effect of U.S. policy, starting with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, has been to advance Iranian national interests and influence in the region at the expense of our traditional security partners, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and UAE, and others. So that this is partly a religious struggle, partly a classic geopolitical struggle, partly a struggle for influence on the political level, and it has now spread to embrace outside countries, the United States, Russia, and others. So this is quite a mess.
Indeed. Well, speaking of Russia, I would like to just turn briefly to the current tensions between the United States and Russia. Some say reaching to the levels of at least a Cold War atmosphere.
Well, I think in the end, European Union, the United States on one side and Russia on the other, have quite compatible interests in Ukraine. Neither of us should want Ukraine to be a bone of contention. Neither of us should want to see it lean to one side or be incorporated into the sphere of influence of the other. So we have an interest in a Ukraine that is neutral, prosperous, strong, cohesive, not an invitation to its neighbors to intervene or interfere. And the question is, how do we get to that result? We actually have a precedent in the Austrian state treaty of, I think, 1956, which created the modern state of Austria, guaranteed its neutrality between East and West, and recognized that both the Soviet Union, the United States, and Europeans, NATO, had an interest in removing Austria from active contention. I think we have the same interest in Ukraine. The problem is that the way we have been approaching this, both Mr. Putin and us, has been through sanctions, counter-sanctions, statements that are insulting and inflammatory in effect, and we have been entrenching the divisions over Ukraine rather than trying to bridge them. But the possibility of a bridge is still there, and I hope we will find a way between Moscow, Washington, and I suppose Berlin is the key decision maker on this in Europe. I hope we will find a way to explore an outcome that we can all live with.
Although many say that Mr. Putin sees the world, in particularly his so-called neighborhood, through the lens of a zero-sum game, and that, you know, for him, Ukraine is essential, and therefore a neutrality might not appeal to him.
Well, I don't think that's consistent with what he's actually said, but it certainly is the theory. And treating Ukraine as a zero-sum game is what we have been doing on both sides, and it has not produced anything useful. So I hope we can get past that.
Let's turn now to China. The United States and China have a very contentious relationship at the moment, particularly with regard to the South China Sea. The Chinese, you know, have declared, you know, an air defense zone which overlaps with their neighbors. It's become more aggressive in making maritime territorial claims. What's your assessment of the United States' posture vis-a-vis this conflict?
Well, there's now a very well-established narrative, which I think is actually not very historically accurate. China's had these claims forever. For a long time, they did nothing to defend them as others expanded into the areas they had traditionally claimed. There are now almost 50 islands, I believe, that have been occupied and populated by Vietnam and the Philippines, for example, since the 1980s. China really hasn't done much until recently. Now it is very vigorously defending its claims, and that seems to be a surprise to everyone. It's doing it in part because it now has the capability to do it, and it's doing it, I think, in part because of an emerging strategic contest with the United States. Americans have, because of the narrative, because of our alliances, because of our sympathy with the underdog, we have ended up basically against China on virtually every one of these issues. That doesn't help, because the Chinese are a big country. They can afford to be magnanimous to small countries, but they can't afford to appear to yield to pressure from the United States. So we're in an impasse, and it's an impasse that's tending toward greater rather than lesser confrontation, which is not good, because we're talking here about confrontation between two great powers, both armed with nuclear weapons, and we're talking about a confrontation that's on China's home ground, not ours. So this is something that the two sides need to look very carefully at and try to deconflict, in my view.
Well, following up on that, because the United States and China are deeply interdependent economically in terms of trade, investment, and finance, but also increasingly distrustfully of each other strategically, particularly over these territorial disputes, how do you think this relationship should be managed?
I think we have a disconnect. We have a very cooperative relationship in the economic and commercial area. There are some problems, but they are relatively minor. And this relationship has helped China to prosper, and it's helped the United States to prosper. And if we're both going to do well in the future, we have to continue along the course of cooperation that we've begun. The area where we have failed has been in the political-military sphere. We have not managed to develop a stable and trusting relationship there, and we need to work very hard at that. There is an opening to do it because President Xi Jinping has put forward the idea of some sort of new type of great power relationship, some redefinition of our relationship that would facilitate the kind of cooperation we need. We've accepted that nominally, but to be honest, there's been very little concrete effort on either side to give this concept content, and we need to do that. We need to find a way of mutual accommodation. The United States needs to recognize that this is China's backyard. It's not 1945. There are strong countries on China's periphery, not weak ones. And we need to redefine our relationship with the region, recognize that China should have a role in managing the areas near its borders. The Chinese, for their part, need to recognize that the United States is part of the scene and is going to remain part of the scene, and that they have to work with us, not against us, in their own interest. So there's a bit of need for give and take that hasn't been apparent on either side.
And Ambassador Freeman, as we conclude, a couple of just larger questions. We're seeing instability from North Africa to the Middle East, Ukraine, and as we discussed, East and South China Seas. The Wall Street Journal says that we're seeing a so-called arch of instability never seen since the 1970s. Do you think the United States is losing its ability to affect geopolitical outcomes in the world?
I think the world is experiencing a devolution of power to the regional level. In every instance, whether it's Ukraine, for example, the framework within which that can be handled is probably the Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe. There have been meetings to try to deal with the Ukraine issue in Berlin where the U.S. wasn't present. This is mostly handled on a regional level. In the Arab world, the Arab League, which was frankly a pretty inactive and useless organization, has become an important body for authorizing cooperation between Arabs and outside powers, including the United States. The absence of an effective regional forum and organization in East Asia is an impediment to dealing with the South China Sea or East China Sea, Senkaku, Diaoyudao issues. But everywhere, what I see going on is a decentralization of global affairs. That inherently reduces American leverage and our ability to influence outcomes.
And then finally, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in a recent interview, in The Atlantic magazine criticized the Obama administration for lacking an organizing foreign policy doctrine, limiting it to not doing stupid things, as President Obama said. Of course, we know it's much more than that. But would you agree with her critique, and why or why not?
Oh, I think she's got a point. But I'm sorry to say I don't see any organizing principle coming from her either. And this is a problem. We have pretty dysfunctional politics in this country at the moment. Almost everything is played out on the gotcha basis. I don't see much serious strategic thinking going on in our political class. It's easy to stand where Mrs. Clinton does and basically pander to the political donor class, to their prejudices. It's good for fundraising, but itself provide the organizing principle she, I think, correctly says the Obama administration also doesn't have. So we need to have a discussion in this country about our purposes and our power and the instruments that we have to influence global affairs in the new circumstances of a much more decentralized world. And we need to have it soon. And I hope, since she's raised the issue, we can have it in connection with the 2016 election.
Ambassador Chaz Freeman is a retired U.S. defense official, diplomat, and interpreter, the author of 5 books, and the recipient of numerous high honors and awards. He's currently chairman of the board of Projects International. That's a Washington-based business development firm. Ambassador Freeman, thank you so much for your terrific insights and for your time.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.